All right, welcome back. Episode 6 of the Sideline Sessions with Wesley Sykes. I am, of course, Wesley Sykes, the managing editor of Coach and Athletic Director, Training and Conditioning, and Winning Hoops Brands for Great American Media Services. And you can listen to our previous episodes anywhere where you can access podcasts, as well as any of our websites, coachad.com, training-conditioning.com, and winninghoops.com. And be sure to follow our brands on Twitter, at coach_AD, at train condition, and at winning hoops, and myself if you'd like, at Wesley Sykes _. But down to brass tacks, today we welcome to the program a sports psychologist and co-author of The Best, How Elite Athletes Are Made, Mark Williams. Mark, thank you very much for taking the time out to join us today. How are you?
Yeah, great. Thanks. My pleasure. Thanks very much for the invitation to come and speak to you and your listeners today.
Yeah, and I love this. I think, during a time of a pandemic, I think book reading is a nice pastime that people can kind of pick up. Maybe they have a little more time on their hands here. So I know this is audio only, but the book here is The Best, How Elite Athletes Are Made, written by yourself and Tim Wigmore as well. So let's start there. What inspired this, and how do you go about answering that question?
Yeah, well, as you said, I've been a sports scientist for 30-odd years. I've worked at various academic institutions in the UK, Australia, and the US. So I guess for me, it was 30 years of research work underpins this particular book. And I'd sort of aspired, I've written a lot of other books, but this is my first venture into popular science, so to speak. And I'd started contacting publishers about the book a couple of years back. And it was suggested that maybe my personal writing style was a little bit academic in nature. So it was suggested that I couple up with someone with more of a journalist background. So Tim Wigmore was recommended to me. Tim is a sports writer for the Daily Telegraph. Mm-hmm. And he and I got together about a year ago. So it, maybe actually longer than that, maybe 18 months ago now. So it took us about 8 months to write the book. And I was very pleased with the way it turned out, to be honest. I think the book combines cutting-edge sports science with a lot of interesting biographical and interview material from leading athletes across different sports.
Yeah, and like we mentioned just before we went to air here, I've got a chance through the first part or so. I think it's about 230-plus pages, right around there, give or take. But I found it a very fascinating read. I'm a slow reader by nature, and I found myself just kind of whizzing right through this. But before we get into that, some of the topic and meat of the book here, I'm just kind of curious about the relationship that you would have with a co-author like this. Because was that your first time meeting Tim?
Yeah, he and I were introduced through a colleague, a mutual colleague, a guy called Matthew Saeed, who's also a well-known popular science author. He wrote Bounce and Rebel Ideas and Black Book Thinking. So Matthew put me in touch with Tim, and we connected quite well. And it was a fascinating journey, actually, in the sense that typically the way we'd work is that I'd write sort of 4,000 or 5,000 words of notes around the science for each chapter. And then Tim would obviously then try and interview various leading athletes and coaches across the different sports. And then he'd try and weave the science around the narrative. And we'd go back and forth on it. So so we did co-write it to some degree. I didn't leave Tim to do all the writing, so to speak. And actually, to be honest, I'd probably say that I didn't provide all the science either. Tim actually came up with some science that I hadn't read prior to him introducing it. So it was a very nice balance, really, of back and forth. A little bit of critical sort of creativity here and there, but I think that was quite healthy. And I think we're both very happy with the way the books turned out.
And I think I asked just because, being in the field of journalism for about a dozen plus years or so, I find it to be a very personal experience, even when you're working with editors and that sort of thing. And, you hold to a lot of your ideas, you maybe hold on to them maybe a little bit firmer than other people's ideas. And that kind of collaborative creative process can be, I would imagine could be difficult at times if that's not something you're typically used to.
Yeah, I mean, positively, I think I mentioned it before. There was a creative tension in
there.
From time to time, that was fine. I think, of course, I was concerned that the science, that we'd be true to the science, and I guess Tim was worried about the appeal of the narrative and the writing to the broad readership that we were hoping to attract. But you know, we went back and forth a few times and numerous drafts, as you do. Mm-hmm. But I can honestly say that I thoroughly enjoyed the process.
Yeah, and I think you probably do want that pushback a little bit too, because without that, you know, you're not going to get that finished product that you're probably hoping for, you know, in anything, right? Yeah. Probably not just in the book writing process.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think having someone with a contrary view on occasion helps. I think either makes you come back and argue the point more strongly, or I guess, you know, you turn around and go, "That I think that's a great idea." And I guess between us, we managed to navigate all those different obstacles. And I would hope that we've come up with a book that appeals to scientists, practitioners, coaches, parents, and anybody who's interested in sport. So I think Tim is happy with the outcome, and I was happy with an outcome. So I think we managed to make it work in that regard. And I hope that's what the readers think.
Yeah. And I think, you know, as we get into that first part of the book, you know, it really dives into the roles that chance and luck play, particularly early on in creating elite athletes. And I guess when I was first reading, I wasn't all that surprised to find that younger siblings are typically the better athletes than the older siblings in that. Because of that competition that we were just kind of talking about. But it was some of the other reasoning behind it that kind of caught me by surprise. For example, the older siblings needing to wait for the parents to introduce to the sports, as opposed to already having a child similar age to be able to introduce it. So what, if anything, you know, surprised you about these findings or anything like that? Because, again, I was really amazed, even looking back to the 2019 women's U.S. Women's soccer title from the Olympics there. Right. It was three quarters of the team was younger siblings. And was it the same for the England women's team as well? About two quarters or so? Two thirds?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the book, just very succinctly, the book is, I guess, split into three sections. And the first part, as you alluded to there, talks about the role of serendipity and environment in the development of expertise. So we focus on topics like, when you're born, where you're born, the role of siblings and family, how are there any early predictors of talent, and how do pro sports identify and select talent, and of course the role of street sport in the development of elite athletes. And then in the middle section, we sort of move on to talk about some of the adaptations that occur through prolonged engagement in sport, such as the development of key psychological skills that underpin expertise. You know, the ability to avoid choking and to be able to perform under pressure, and the development of game intelligence skills, like the ability to anticipate and make the right decisions under pressure. And then in the final section, we focus more so on the role of coaching and having the right system processes in place for the development of elite athletes. You know, what types of practice are most beneficial in promoting the acquisition of skill? But I guess it's not much of it surprised me, because having
you've been living it.
I've been living it for 30 odd years. I mean, I guess perhaps Tim might have been surprised by some of the things that came up as we went along. But coming back to your main question, I mean, the issue about siblings is quite interesting, isn't it? And in regards to your specific question, maybe the thing is that, you know, when parents have their first child, then they might introduce them to the sport at maybe 4, 5, or 6 years of age. And then, of course, when the second sibling comes along, then the younger sibling, then the parents usually take the younger sibling with them to watch the older sibling engage in sport. And in that way, the younger sibling is exposed to the sport at an earlier age than the older sibling. And clearly, the younger sibling has the opportunity to learn from their older sibling, whether that's through observation or, of course, through playing about with their older brothers and sisters in the back garden and in and around these kinds of practice sessions. So whilst, of course, being born an older sibling does not mean that you won't make it as a professional athlete,
right?
It's just statistically your chances of becoming an elite athlete are higher if you're a younger sibling. And there's quite a lot of empirical evidence for that.
So is there any evidence that you've searched, or have you kind of dug a little deep on this question, that if the younger sibling has the higher probability of becoming an elite athlete, does an older sibling have a higher probability of becoming a coach per se? That might be half in jest, but I think there's yeah. some half-baked logic in there.
Well, there is an argument to some degree that elite athletes are very much a product of an environment, or humans generally are a product of an environment. So, I mean, it's a logical suggestion. I'm unaware of any evidence, empirical evidence that has actually looked at that, but maybe there's a PhD thesis in there somewhere for sure. It's an interesting question.
Yeah, and I think also, you know, you mentioned, serendipity and being a product of your environment. It also came out in the book there that you said that mid-sized cities, right, 50 to 100,000 yeah. population were the best settings to produce, or the best setting to produce the highest amount of elite athletes. And could you go into, you know, how you came about that?
Sure. Well, mid-sized towns provide the best balance, I guess, in the mm-hmm. sense that small towns perhaps don't have access to enough opponents to play against of the right level, maybe not enough coaches, infrastructure and facilities may be less well developed. Whereas in contrast, in the really large towns, then, you know, there's competition. There's mm-hmm. A lot of kids who want to play sport, often not enough teams, not enough coaches, not enough facilities to allow everybody to engage. Whereas I guess mid-sized towns provide that nice balance in the sense that there's enough players to play with and against. There's enough access to good quality coaches. And there are often adequate facilities for the kids to play the sport, whether indoors or outdoors. So it seems to provide the best balance all around for an environment for the development of elite players.
And did that take into account at all finances or financial standing or economic standings in that in regions, you know, based on mid-sized cities or anything like that?
The particular research that looked at the size of the town didn't specifically, if I recall accurately, look at the socioeconomic backgrounds of those kids as well. But I think you raise a good point in the sense that parents or mentors and carers play quite a significant role in mm-hmm. Introducing children to the sport. And often, of course, that involves some outlay of resources, maybe more so in the US for joining sports clubs than in Europe, and often a fair amount of travel. So often parents and significant others have to sacrifice a lot in order to allow their kids the opportunity to play sport and to develop in sport. And, of course, those challenges are greater in sports which are more costly to play. So perhaps tennis, golf, skiing, for instance, are sports that may require more of a financial outlay sure. than playing, you know, street soccer or street basketball. So clearly those factors impact as well.
Well, you know, I asked because I think you also pointed to a 2019 England World Cup rugby team, right? That was mostly comprised of private schools specializing particularly in rugby. And I wonder if that has anything to do, again, with the financial access of things. You know, is it choosing a school that is fully committed to producing like a total athlete or total student athlete? Or is it necessarily just, you know, being able to buy or get into the best schools possible?
Yeah, I mean, you're alluding to the right point there in the sense that I guess often private schools have better facilities, lower student-to-teacher ratios.
Sure, yeah.
And they tend to invest more money in coaches. So it's not so much the money per se, although indirectly it is, of course, but it's more the fact that these kids are in an environment which have better facilities, better resources, better coaching. And also there's in a lot of these schools, we talk about Millfield School here in mm-hmm. the UK, which has provided a lot of Olympic athletes for Team GB.
over the last few years. And, you know, there's very much a community of learning there as well, in that there are people across different sports, golf, football, cricket, athletics, and they all interact in an environment that is focused towards excellence in education as well as excellence in sport. So yeah, it's more about the environment and the access and opportunities that comes indirectly from having additional funding to invest in those areas.
Yeah, and I think, you know, things that maybe don't cost money, you know, level of commitment within student, you know, within that is going to push one another, you know, commitment to coach or to the programs, right? That's going to go beyond just how much money you can pour into a facility or something, but still maybe get the results that you're looking for at the end of the day.
Yeah, I mean, you're right. Certainly passion, interest are strongly related to motivation and commitment to continue to engage in practice over a prolonged period of time. I don't know of any research that has specifically looked at whether those levels of motivation or interest are higher within schools that are better funded or not. It's an interesting question. But certainly, I guess, irrespective of one's socioeconomic background, it's unlikely that you'll progress to higher levels in sport without those high levels of passion and interest and motivation. And of course, you know, it's not a smooth path to excellence.
Sure.
Lots of ups and downs. So other psychological skills like resilience, mental toughness, are also quite integral in that journey.
I ask because, you know, we're like I said, I'm based out of Massachusetts, and there's a town that's in between two very affluent towns. And they produced, in particular, one village within this town produced about 8 to 10, you know, NCAA collegiate basketball players that had some sort of degree of success playing overseas or now in coaching or, you know, different things like that, different cups of coffee at pro spots along the way. But it was that one particular hotbed that produced all these areas. And again, it wasn't, you know, the most affluent town, didn't necessarily have the best school systems, but for whatever reason, this group of 8 to 10 kids who all lived on a 2-block radius of one another, you know, all went on to varying levels of collegiate basketball. And I always found that amazing, of how you could have, you know, what is a statistical anomaly, what seems like, but still have such a high rate in one particular area.
Yeah, and there are quite a few examples of that ilk. I guess historically you could think of, for instance, tennis in Sweden, in the kind of Björn Borg, Mats Wilander kind of area, where a lot of the elite tennis players in Sweden came from a very small part of Sweden. And I guess clearly you need to have a look and do some research to try and identify what are the underlying factors there. I mean, it may well be that there was just a very talented coach or group of coaches that lived in that particular area, or it may be that in that particular community that invested a significant amount of money in playing facilities and training facilities, and that sparked interest in kids so that they were more motivated to engage in the sport. But these clusters or communities of excellence are not uncommon. But there may be a range of different factors that may contribute to why that is. And I guess without looking into the devil in the details, so to speak, of the local community you're on about, there are probably a range of factors that might have led to that situation.
I think we've touched on this already partially, is the idea of parenting, right? And being there, but there's the fine line of helicopter parenting, which I think in your book there showed that there was measurable data showing a negative correlation between helicopter parents and the success of young athletes, right? So how do you find that fine line between pushing your kids to want to do well and maybe pursue something that they're legitimately interested in, and then pushing your ideals, you know, onto your son or daughter?
Yeah, that's as much of an art as a science, isn't it?
Yeah, right, right.
And you could say pretty much the same question as far as coaches, in the sense of, you know, when do you provide direct instruction and feedback to athletes, or when do you have a more hands-off approach and allow the athletes to discover solutions to problems on their own. And clearly, as I said before, parents play an integral role in driving the kid's initial interest in the sport. But, you know, ultimately that passion and interest really has to come from the child, in my opinion, or else they won't be able to sustain that level of passion and interest over a prolonged period of time. So the balance for the parents is doing enough to get them potentially involved in the sport and make sure that there's opportunities for them to engage in that sport and being supportive as much as possible. But at the same time, ultimately, in a competitive environment, the kids have to play on their own. They can't play with their parents. So it's very important that they have the opportunity to learn independently. And then there's an element of trial and error learning in that. You know, it's for all of us, it's not always a smooth journey. And sometimes there are rocky roads or speed bumps along the way. But that's an all important part of development, in the sense that it creates more resilient and grittier athletes.
Mm-hmm. And it's not even necessarily, parents just pushing on their ideals or living vicariously through their children. But I think your book even touches on a nice little excerpt about a tennis player who would, you know, pull the strings of his racket and then couldn't, you know, I'll just have my mom do it between sets or between matches or something. And then, you know, is that actually creating, you know, the best individual athlete that you can have?
Yeah, and the example you refer to there is from actually Judy Murray, who's the mother of Andy Murray, a Grand Slam winner, and Jamie Murray, who's a doubles Grand Slam winner. And she was quite involved in clearly the early development of the kids. She was a tennis coach herself, and actually she coached across all of Scotland for tennis. And she made it clear that she actually created scenarios where Jamie and Andy could learn from those scenarios. And that it wasn't always her job to say, well, you know, this is the way to solve the problem. Sometimes it's her sort of role as a coach to present problems, mm-hmm. so that the kids have the opportunity and the experience of finding solutions to those problems. So, as I said, that they're the challenges. I mean, some of those behaviors, I guess, are what may be more appropriate behaviors, can be informed by the science, and a lot of it is presented in the book. But, you know, but there is an art form to this as well.
Sure.
To some degree. So it's an example of how, certainly parenting can be informed by the science, but ultimately there is a craft to it.
The art, everyone reacts to different things differently, right? So someone may react more positively to being harder or kind of more stricter or militant style, regimented style, and then someone who can just be more laid back and maybe that's more receptive there. Switching gears a little bit, we've heard this cliche so many times in the sports world of the game slows down. You know, you're talking to someone post game, player of the game hit a game winning home run, that sort of thing. And they said, "What'd you see? What, take me through the play. What happened?" And they said, "The game was just slowing down for me. You know, I was seeing the game very slow." So is it better to have a fast brain than fast feet in athletics? And if so, why is that?
Well, ideally, you'd want both. Fast brain, and then I guess you'd be worth quite a lot of money one way or other. I mean, yes, what happens is that through prolonged engagement in the sport, experts develop these knowledge structures in memory that allow them to process information in the display in a much more effective and efficient manner. And clearly, in many fastball sports, there are quite severe sort of time constraints. So, you know, you don't have all the time in the world, so to speak. You know, you've got to make decisions quickly and you've got to process large amounts of information, take it in, make the right decision at the right time, often when fatigued, when under stress, anxiety. And what experts develop is the ability to be able to anticipate or to read the game rather than to react to what's happening. So they're able to, for instance, pick up information from the body shape of an opponent that helps them to be able to anticipate, you know, where the serve is going to go, what type of baseball pitch it's going to be. And they are better able to identify structure and patterns in evolving sequences of play. And beyond that, they're also very accurate in making probabilistic judgments as to, mm-hmm. given the context, the situation, the scenario, what might happen next. So this is, I guess, what we mean when we talk about game intelligence. I mean, experts develop, we actually call them perceptual cognitive skills. But they're not visual skills per se. There's a little bit of a misnomer in the sense that often you'll watch sport on television and the commentator will go, well, the athlete's got a great eye or super vision. But that actually isn't the case. I mean, you know, when we've tested elite and sub-elite athletes across a number of different sports, there are no differences in the quality of visual system function per se. You know, these athletes don't have Superman vision, so to speak. It's more in regards to the fact that they see different things. So they process information much more effectively. And of course, you know, we can all look at the same thing, but we see different things. And that, I think, is a pivotal characteristic of expertise, certainly in fastball sports and team ball sports.
Yeah, and I think it was in relation to some English Premier League soccer players there. I think it was actually a Spanish player. I'm blanking on the name here, but how many frames or pictures that his mind would essentially take per minute, and it was something like 0.84 blinks per minute. I'm blanking on there, so I apologize. Maybe you can help fill in the blanks here, but it really, like, he had a photographic memory.
Well, in essence, what the players do, these are soccer players, and what the research did is they videoed players as they performed in matches, and what they looked at was the frequency with which they rotated their head in order to be able to see different pictures of the field. And as you suggested, they found that with the better players like Xavi from Spain, Frank Lampard, Steven Gerrard, when they were playing in the Premier League at the time, they had much higher rates of scanning the visual display. And this is one important skill, being able to take these visual pictures of the playing field as the action unfolds. But then at the same time, of course, they also have the ability to better interpret the information that they're actually looking at, you know, to pick up these key postural movements from a teammate and an opponent to identify these structures, patterns, and formations. So in some ways, the experts are virtually working like supercomputers. You know, they're actually taking in and processing large amounts of time very, very quickly and effectively. And that makes them look as if they've got all the time in the world, of course. Or as you said, it creates the analogy that they're play is going on in slow motion around them.
Yeah. So some of us operate on 5G and some of us are still on dial-up, right?
that's a pretty good analogy.
Yeah. So I'm going to come up with another analogy here. I'm promised to land this plane, but I think it ties into what we were discussing and goes into my next question here. Are you a poker player by any chance? You ever play poker?
I play cards a few times, but I wouldn't. No, I'm not a serious poker player for sure.
Well, if you sat down at the table with a professional poker player, you know, I almost feel like the table's even at that point, because that professional poker player knows how to play by the book, every right move, every wrong move, every time that when you should raise, when you should fold, that whole thing. And if you're a novice poker player stepping down at a table, all those rules go out the window. He's a wild card. She's a wild card. You can't really predict that. And it's that idea that I think you touched on in the second part of your book here a little bit, is that idea of deception. And being able to prepare only for so much of what you know to prepare for, but you can't prepare for the unknown, right? So I think Trevor Bauer kind of gets into this a little bit with his pitch angles. He's a free agent pitcher now, but he was on the Cleveland Indians. And I believe there was another tennis player as well who was playing the number one player at the time. Maybe it was in the French Open, if I believe.
That's right. It was Michael Chang against Pete Sampras.
Yes, thank you.
Chang
did
the infamous underhand serve.
Right. And again, you're not preparing for it. You're in the French Open. You're playing in a Grand Slam tournament. You're probably not anticipating an underhand serve. So, how do you counteract, all of this preparation and everything that they do to kind of process information and slow it down, and to throw a hit, a wrench in that whole process like that with an underhand serve or a repeated arm slot or the underhand free throws from Rick Barry?
Yeah, I mean, and there's quite a bit of evidence that suggests that actually experts are more likely to be fooled by information that is incongruent with what they initially predict to happen. Because what happens is they create what they call heuristics, which is a rule about, given the context and the situation, this is what's most likely to happen next. And that novices don't have those high level heuristics, so therefore they tend not to predict so far in advance, so they're less likely to be perceived by that. Yeah, I mean, it's a difficult balance, isn't it? On one side of the coin, you've got this need to be able to anticipate what's going to happen before it actually happens, because it gives you more time to move and respond. But then the other side of the coin is the danger, of course, of anticipating incorrectly or being deceived by an opponent, or the opponent disguising what's going to happen next. So you can almost see that there's like a constant process of hedging your bets going on. You know, so, you know, tennis players with the balls going back and forth, you know, there's almost a cost-benefit analysis that goes on. You know, should I anticipate? If I anticipate, will I get it right? What if I get it wrong? Where's that going to lead me? And actually, what you find is that whilst anticipation might be crucial to winning those kinds of points in tennis, it doesn't actually occur on every shot, because mm-hmm. the player might actually determine that there's too much of a risk to anticipate. So he or she will play a percentage shot, if you like, and mm-hmm. stay in the rally until he or she is more certain about what kind of anticipation judgment might be correct.
And just circling back to, you know, fast brain and your mind processing everything, kind of having that sped up mind's eye. Is there anything that you can do? I'm sure there's a lot of technology out there that can kind of help aid this as you go on, especially as you get up to the higher levels. But can a game like chess that's more strategic, I'm especially thinking in terms of, you know, American football or you know, the European style football there, where that seems to be more strategic and there's a lot of places, you know, pieces in play, so to speak. Is there any benefit to that there?
Well, one of the strongest rules of expertise is actually specificity. So in other words, the practice environment must mm-hmm. mimic and often exceed the demands of competition. So the empirical evidence around the transferability of skills across sports is actually not as strong as you might think. Yes, there's a lot of intuitive anecdotal evidence, but the empirical evidence is quite strong, quite weak rather. So in essence, the argument is that rather than trying to, for instance, improve visual function by different optometric exercises, for instance, what you need to do is to develop the knowledge base that underpins this perception and decision-making process. So, I mean, obviously, good quality coaching, mm-hmm. use of video feedback, and increasingly so the use of technology. So virtual reality and right. video simulations are being developed that recreate match situations where you can actually put players back into the situation from a match that they just played in a couple of days before. Or, of course, you could put some developing athletes into mm-hmm. decision-making situations that were actually faced by the elite players in the preceding game. So whilst virtual reality will never replace practice, real practice in real match situations, I think it does offer a nice medium to you know, present targeted practice around the development of these kinds of skills. But ultimately, beyond that, of course, there's a very strong correlation between the hours accumulated in practice and match play and the development of game-specific skills. So players aren't born with these skills, so to speak. They acquire them over a prolonged period of engagement in the sport.
This question here is very important to me. I'm a Southpaw myself. So are lefties better athletes?
Being left-handed has some advantages. The two ones discussed notably in the book are, let's take an example of tennis, for instance. I mean, there are far fewer left-handed tennis players than right-handed tennis players. So tennis players get a lot of exposure to watching right-handed players, but they get relatively less exposure to playing against left-handed players. So there is empirical evidence to suggest, for instance, that it's harder for tennis players to anticipate a left-hander. And it's probably because of this perceptual familiarity effect. So, and that's evident in lots of other sports as well, of course, particularly sports that are sort of very fast sports that mm-hmm. demand rapid responses. And then in some other sports, you know, like golf or baseball, for instance, or cricket, there may be some advantages in batting in a reverse stance because it places the usually the dominant right hand on the top of the bat.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly there are some advantages of being an elite golfer if you're left hand dominant.
I haven't found those yet. I'm still searching.
No, you know, I'm right handed and right footed.
Yeah. So I'm lefty all the way around. My dad, I'm the only left handed person in my family. My father taught me how to play golf, I don't know, like 12, 13 years old or so. And sure. He tried for a solid 2 weeks to put that right-handed club in my hand, so we didn't have to buy left-handed clubs. And God bless him, he tried, but just did not work around. So yeah, he had a pony up.
No. Well, maybe it doesn't work for everyone.
Yeah, exactly. Here, why do athletes choke?
Well, I mean, invariably, pressure is the big factor. I mean, this kind of, anxiety arises if you perceive that you do not have the competencies and the characteristics necessary to deal with the stress that you're about to face. And if you're playing against a big opponent or a big team, then I guess uncertainties and doubt come into that process. So some psychological skills are very important, like, for instance, self-confidence, locus of control, feeling in control of the situation, mental toughness, are all sort of psychological skills that are important in avoiding choking. And in terms of some sports, particularly fixed sports, like, for instance, golf putting or playing a serve in tennis, having preset routines that are well-developed stops you sort of reinvesting effort. So it's what they call a reinvestment theory, in that when you become anxious, you tend to think about aspects of the movement that have previously become automated. So they often refer to it as paralysis by analysis, for instance.
Yeah, I've heard those.
So,
and there are people who have written books on the concept, of course, in a game of tennis, for instance, where if your opponent is playing particularly well 1 week, then what you should probably say to them is, well, you're serving well today. What are you doing differently this week compared to last week? And that actually promotes this reflection, inward reflection about, yeah, I am serving well, aren't I? Why, what am I doing differently? So then all of a sudden aspects of the movement that have become automated come under conscious control. And then, of course, when you start overthinking and overanalyzing things, then choking is the likely scenario that comes out of that particular process.
You brought up, tennis and golf. I think those sports, and particularly some stagnant sports too, when you think of even baseball. But when those solo sports, I feel like that mental toughness is almost going to be as important as your strength and conditioning routine there. Especially because I just think, if there's a sort of self-fulfilling prophecy, maybe is the term that I want to use. But if you already have doubt creeping in your head, you're going to manifest it, right, in a certain way. If you think you're going to lose, then you're probably already lost, right? Isn't that kind of an old kind of sports cliche to use again?
Yeah, it's what they call stereotypical threat, I guess. If you know that you might have choked previously in that situation, or your team has not done well in these kinds of scenarios, then it does tend to facilitate or foster a mindset that the same kinds of problems are going to arise in future. The reverse of that, of course, is the stereotypical lift. And we personify in the book with Ian Poulter, the golfer, playing in the Ryder Cup, where, when he plays well, then usually the European team wins the Ryder Cup. So there's a nice example of stereotypical lift in there. But there are some good examples also of stereotypical threat, of teams who have continually choked in different situations. I mean, England football team, England soccer team in the World Cup in penalty shootouts. It was one prime example of a stereotypical threat. But there's no doubt that the relationship between stress and performance is a crucial one in sport, in that clearly you need some aspects of stress in order to drive yourself forward to be successful. But then it's how do you control that stress moving forward is important.
I don't know how else to describe this, but a psychological issue maybe is the yips. Something maybe it's called a couple of different things, depending on what sport you're playing. But you see it so often in baseball, pitchers who, can't throw back to the catcher, you know, in a non-pitching situation or can't throw to first base or something along those lines. How do those problems develop, and then how do you work past them? I think Rick Ankiel, I don't know if that's a name that's familiar to you as all, really hot shot young pitcher for the St. Louis Cardinals, I believe, back in like the early 2000s, and then couldn't, you know, wild pitch left and right, sending everything home, and had this great comeback career as a hitter. But it took him like 5 or 6 years to kind of reprogram his brain almost. So can you go into, you know, how someone develops the gifts, and then again, how you get out of it?
I mean, this kind of relates back to some of the things we spoke about earlier as well. And this is one of the other advantages of more hands-off approaches to instruction, I guess, in the sense that when coaches are not overly prescriptive, then athletes get the opportunity to learn skills in a more implicit manner. So they don't have these, you know, wide array of if-then-do rules, for instance, about what they should do in any given situation. So they're less likely to suffer from paralysis by analysis. So coaching and instruction plays a big part in that. I mean, sports psychologists can play a big role as well in terms of trying to develop strategies that facilitate self-confidence, increase levels of mental toughness, and that help athletes potentially develop routines where they can stay in the now rather than beginning this process of reinvesting and thinking about all the things that went wrong in the past. So there is hope for everyone. I mean, clearly some of our psychological characteristics have a genetic aspect to them, but at the same time, there's lots of evidence to suggest that the key psychological factors that are important to elite performance can be developed over time. And, sports psychologists, for instance, can help a great deal in trying to develop some of those key skills like resilience and mental toughness and self-confidence, which are very important to maintaining control in high-pressure situations, not just in sport, of course, but across all domains of life.
Do you think, athletes turn to sports psychologists now? Do you think that has increased a little bit more as more people kind of become more aware and the topic of mental health becomes more on the forefront of everybody? You think athletes are more receptive to that sort of treatment?
Yeah, I mean, I would say so. I've been in this field for 30 odd years, and I would say that increasingly so, psychology has been embraced more so by elite athletes and also by coaches. Mm-hmm. And I guess not only in terms of the high performance end of it, but also, have you suggested, in terms of aspects around mental health, which are equally important to athletes throughout their careers, really, during main years of competition and, of course, into retirement. There are increasing evidence to suggest that mental health is a big factor. So, yeah, it's a growth area. And most of the top athletes now have sports psychologists that they work with on a regular basis. Perhaps in keeping with the point that you said earlier, it might not suit everyone. Mm-hmm. I mean, there is some aspect of individual differences here. Some people take to it and take it well and find that it's crucial for them. Maybe others less so, but that's part of the process of being an expert as well, isn't it? Working out what works for you and what doesn't.
Yeah, I like that. I think that's well said there. You've sufficiently answered all of my questions here. I do have one portion that I like to do with all my guests before we say goodbye here. It's called 5 questions that have nothing to do with sports. So just as the title suggests, I'm going to go almost lightning round-esque and wrap off some questions here. And whatever comes to mind for you first, we'll spout off here. Does that sound like a fair game?
Sounds good.
All right. So episode is going to be coming out on December 31st, so just still in the Christmas time. Okay. Here, what is your favorite childhood holiday gift?
That's a good question. Probably my first ever pair of soccer boots.
Okay.
They were white.
They're not black, I imagine.
They were white, which in the 1970s was quite unusual because most soccer boots were always black in those days.
Yeah. Okay. So you had a little flash game there. Huh? You stood out on the pitch.
Yeah, absolutely. It was a creative player.
Yeah. I like that. What was the last concert you went to? I can't imagine we've been to one recently, but what was the last concert and did you like it?
I did. I saw Sam Smith in the Vivint Arena in Salt Lake City about 18 months ago, I think.
How was it? Because didn't he recently have, I thought he had vocal surgery. He couldn't
see
while he was
I don't know. He was great. He was a bit more charismatic and a bit more engaging than I thought, actually. I thought he'd be a little bit more introverted, but he made a good show of it. I enjoyed it.
All right. I love that.
It's a good album.
Yeah. Okay. I'll give that a check. Maybe that's some good holiday music here. Does it sing around the Christmas tree? What is your biggest pet peeve when you're driving on the road?
Well, I drive in the US and the UK, so I've got to make sure I drive on the right side of the road. My pet peeve while driving in the US actually is the fact that people hog that middle lane.
Yeah.
Whereas in the UK, you're actually required to pull over onto the right hand side, if I've got that right. But
driving in the left lane, that's it for you.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'm still not sure I've got used to undertaking in the US. You can only overtake in the UK. So lots of peeves around that.
What do you mean by that? Undertake and overtake?
Well, in the UK, when you're driving on a motorway, you're meant to stay in the inside lane, which is the slow lane, unless you're overtaking. Then you can go in the middle lane and the outside lane.
I see, yeah.
Whereas in the US, correct me if I'm wrong on this, but I've been doing this for a few years now, you can undertake and overtake, so you can pass a vehicle in any lane.
Yes, yeah. I don't think you'll get pulled over or a ticket for that. It might be like one of those unwritten rules. Maybe it's just frowned upon or something. Yeah, but I'm guilty of that all the time too, so you're not going to hear any guff from me. I think for me, it's like, it always depends. If I'm driving, I hate the runner or the bicyclist on the road. But if I'm a bicyclist or a runner, I hate the cars. You know, so I think what it boils down to is I just don't like other people.
Yeah, that's true. I've noticed that a bit more in lockdown, actually, where because the gyms were closed, I had to go out cycling on my bike. And I've not historically been a great cycler. But yeah, cyclists are the least popular people on the planet, aren't they? Everybody hates them. The pedestrians, the drivers, even
they don't
cyclists.
Want you on the sidewalk, they don't want you on the road. Where do you go?
Oh, that's right. That's right. Yeah.
Which two historical figures would you host a dinner party for, and what would you serve?
In a sports context, or just historically?
Anywhere, yeah. Dealer's choice.
I suppose Churchill. Most Brits would probably go for Churchill.
It's a good one.
And who else would I? Let's go for someone a little bit more recent. I'm a big Manchester United supporter. So how about someone like Eric Cantona or even Cristiano Ronaldo, if I go for someone even more recent?
Oh, sure. My wife would love this. She is of Portuguese descent, so big Ronaldo fans in this household.
Good. And what would I serve them? I'd serve them the only dish I could cook, which is chili con carne.
Oh, that sounds really good, though, actually. It's like a diner. If you go to a diner and the menu's huge, you know they don't do anything well. But if it's small, you know they do those couple things well. So if you got one thing in your arsenal that you can cook well, you know, like, that's what I would want to have.
Yeah, unless you could provide me with a fee for this appearance on the show, and then I can get in a professional chef to entertain you.
There we go. Yeah, I like that, too. That's also a good one.
It'll be on you.
Yeah. Okay. All right. I can do it. I can whip up something good too. You know, I used to work in the restaurant industry before making it big here on Coach and Athletic Director. So again, like I said, New Year's Eve, this episode's coming out here. So do you have any New Year's resolutions?
Well, everybody's hoping for normality, aren't they? I mean, for someone who spent most of their career traveling around the world, giving talks to different places, it would be good to leave the house at some point in the new year. So my resolution would be to leave the house more often than I did in 2020.
I like that. That's good. I think that's an attainable goal too, hopefully.
Well, I would hope so, with the vaccine starting to kick in.
Yeah.
Maybe let's be positive, and by Easter there might be a sense of normality.
I love it here. I think for me, if there has to be something, you know, I think I'd like to spend my mornings a little bit more in meditation. Instead of just getting right up and getting into it, yeah, as I get creeping older in age, you know, I think some of those things I'm starting to embrace a little bit more. And I want to buy a house. want to get a house this year. Yeah, that's my goal.
Wow, lofty goals indeed.
Yeah, why not? Right, meditate in a house. That seems a good plateful.
One materialistic and one not.
Yeah,
good balance.
Yin and yang.
Yeah, maybe I should sort of hope for a Porsche or a Lamborghini or something.
Yeah, and then to balance out the getting outside.
Balance out the previous one. Yeah.
No, no one's going to be mad at you. I won't fault you for that. We can go back and add that in there. But again, okay. Yeah, great. So you successfully survived five questions that have nothing to do with sports. So congratulations to you. And thank you, actually, so much for taking the time out to speak with us today. Best of luck with the book moving forward. I think this would make a great stocking stuffer for any last-minute holiday shoppers out there. So for the folks out there, where can we find your book, The Best, How Elite Athletes Are Made? And where can the people get in touch with you?
Amazon. It's probably the best place to buy the book.
Okay.
And
spot. I guess,
yeah, you can get hold of me. But if anybody wants to drop me an email, I usually reply mark.williams@health.utah.edu. Or I guess if you just type in Mark Williams Sports Science on the internet, I'm sure there'll be a few hits that come forward. A
couple of good links in there. Always important to have good SEO. In your business there. So again, thank you very much. And you can follow us once again on Twitter as well, @coach_AD, @traincondition, @winninghoops, and myself @WesleySykes_. And you want to follow those accounts moving forward to get a first look at who our next guest will be for our seventh episode, which will be kicking off the new year 2021. Hopefully it'll be better than what 2020 has provided us, which will be released on January 14th. But until then, sports fans, my name is Wesley Sykes, and thank you for tuning in to another episode of Sideline Sessions, and thank you, Mark.
Thank you. Enjoyed it.